Welcome to Profiles. I'm your host, Shauna Ritter, and my guest today is Dan Matthews. Dan is the Senior Vice President of People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, also known as PETA, the largest animal rights organization in the world. Dan is well known in the press for heading PETA's wild and oftentimes controversial campaigns, such as the I'd Rather Go Naked Than Wear Fur. He counts among his friends and supporters Pamela Anderson, Sir Paul McCartney, and Pink. In 2007, Dan was ranked 37th in Out Magazine's 50 Most Powerful Gay Men and Women in America. His recently released book is called Committed, a Rabble Rouser's Memoir. Welcome to Profiles, Dan.
Hello there.
I'm so glad you're with us.
Delighted to be here.
Tell me a little bit. You grew up in Southern California, in a rather conservative area of Southern California. When you were growing up in the 70s and 80s, what did you envision for yourself?
I envisioned the first bus out of Southern California. I always felt like I had been born into the wrong world. I know it's the promised land for most people because the beach and, you know, even Orange County specifically, it's considered one of the most beautiful places. But I love the city, I love the country, and I hate the suburbs. And Southern California is a giant suburb, and I don't care if there's a beach there. I don't care if there's a big mall there. I wanted to go to a crumbling, rotting old city or to, the countryside. It was also frustrating for me, who was always obsessed with history, to grow up in one of the newest cities in the world, where the oldest building you could find was maybe 50 years old. So I saved up my money waiting tables and dancing as a Christmas tree at Disneyland. And right after I got out of high school, I saved up $1,000 and moved to Rome, Italy, where I ended up really starting my life when I was about 17. No credit cards, didn't know anybody, but ended up staying 2 years.
How was your Italian?
I didn't speak any Italian at the time, but I got there and made a rule that I would not befriend anybody who spoke English until I was fluent in Italian. And there were a lot of frustrating, tearful nights the first few months. But then one day at the post office, I realized I was eavesdropping on the people behind me in line. And then I thought, wow, I understand now. So, you know, I ran out of $1,000 after a few months, and so I had to figure other ways to stay in the country. And one of the first ways, which my roommate showed me how to do, is to work the streets. You know, I'm gay, but I'd never had sex before. And my roommate said, there's this particular street you can walk down near the park. And honestly, cars will stop and offer you $50 to get in and have sex. And I thought, well, might as well get paid to learn. That was how I broke the ice. In a number of ways. So it wasn't that involved, and it was interesting. And enough cars would stop. You know, I'm 6'5", and I had white hair at the time because I was still a punk rocker. And everybody thought I was kind of rough trade. They had no idea that I was like this green teen. But it was very interesting, and it gave me I've always loved an insight into other people's worlds. And sometimes you get that insight through these odd connections. And you certainly get a window onto another world when you're a street hustler. So it's very fascinating to me. But that gave me the confidence to follow up on my friend's tips that I try to become a model or an actor. And within a few months of working the streets, I did a Fiat audition and was the Fiat spokesperson for 1984 and got all this money. It was crazy. And so I didn't have to work the streets anymore. And I ended up doing stupid, you know, spaghetti Western music videos, fashion shows. And just as I really thought, God, I didn't expect to come here and make it like this. My volunteer work, which I was doing all the time, was for animal rights groups. And so all of a sudden, my life started turning itself around a little bit. And sure, I had money and, you know, kind of an exciting job. But what I really wanted to be doing was what I was doing as a volunteer in the evenings, the animal rights work. I wanted to do that all day. I'd be sitting on a movie set and thinking, God, in the 8 hours that I've sat here doing nothing, I could have plastered canceled stickers over every circus poster in Rome. You know, spray painted a fur shop or whatever else.
I understand the desire, strong desire to change things and make things better. But why specifically were you drawn to the cause of animal rights?
Well, I grew up in a very, very liberal home. My mother grew up in orphanages, and she is kind of she doesn't describe herself as a communist, but more of a Trotskyite, very specific kind of socialist outlook. And I guess that comes from growing up in orphanages during the Great Depression, where you have very, very little and have to struggle for anything you do have. But she also had a great sense of humor, and she also had a great empathy for animals. So we were just taught to react to the news that was happening in the world, not just sit there like a couch potato. So she explained to us gay rights issues when we were like 7, 8 years old, women's rights issues, Native America, just any issues.
You and your two brothers, right?
Me and my two brothers, that's right. And we lived in a really scummy neighborhood, if you can imagine that there are scummy neighborhoods in Orange County, California. And the alley cats started to get mutilated. They would have their heads crushed in dumpster lids just for fun by bullies in the alleyway. So our apartment, where they didn't allow any animals, kind of became the sanctuary. And so that's when we first learned to do that. We took in all these animals. I had no idea there was such a thing as an animal shelter. I just thought that's what you did when you saw a bedraggled animal on the street. It was kind of your responsibility as part of your civic outlook. Then I used to go on fishing trips with my dad all the time. And it always bugged me. But I went along with it because it's your dad and you're 9 years old or whatever. I was always uncomfortable, especially about live bait. Live bait really kind of was bizarre to me. You took this squirming thing, put a hook through his gill, and then dangled him into the water like some, you know, puppet. And you had your finger on the line while you felt this tiny little creature desperately struggling to get away from some bigger creature that was about to chomp down on him. And as I sat there on the boat looking around at all these older men doing this and everybody doing it, I just thought, this is the definition of sadism right here, plain and simple. You're getting off on something else's misery. And I don't really want a part of it. I should be punished for doing this. I should not be encouraged to do it. But I was the only one that felt like that. And, you know, right around the time when I was about 13 or so, I used to get beat up at school for being gay, for being a punk rocker. And one time between classes, somebody slugged me in the stomach for no reason. They just called me fag and slugged me in the stomach. And I was laying on the pavement, gasping for breath. And I looked up and there was just all these people looking down and laughing because the fag got punched. And it was just, it was awful. Well, about a month or so later, I was on a fishing trip with my dad when I hauled in this really big, ugly flounder and got him on the boat. And flounder was a big joke fish, a big rubbery bottom feeder. And I got him on the boat. Somebody stomped on him, ripped the hook out. And here was this pathetic creature just gasping for breath and looking up with these two ugly eyes, only to look at all these people looking down and laughing at him. And I felt like that was me, the flounder. Only now I was the bully. And so that's when I stopped eating fish and soon stopped eating all the rest of meat.
Became a vegetarian.
So it was not through a leaflet. It was not through proselytizing. My dad, in fact, drove a chicken truck. It was just through my own personal experience with watching animals suffer and die at my own hand that I thought, you know, I'm better than this. I'm not so pathetic that I need to reduce myself to sadism to enjoy myself in nature. And so that's how I really became a vegetarian.
You know, it's sort of an interesting comparison when you think about being a punk rocker and then thinking about the notion of becoming a vegetarian. They seem to be an antithesis to each other. How did one draw you? You explained how vegetarianism got you, but how were you drawn to being a punk rocker?
Well, you know, I always felt like I was from another planet. I always felt like I didn't really belong, you know, especially in Southern California, but really in the world. I mean, I have a pretty sick sense of humor. You know, I find like-minded people all over the place, but they're far and few between. I always just felt a little bit different, and I never understood why everybody has this drive to be just like everybody else and to be appreciated and liked by everybody else and to do anything to get a date and then even more to keep a date, bending your personality out of shape. I just always thought, you know, you save a lot of time in life if you're just yourself, regardless of what people think. And then in the late 70s, there was this girl in high school, the first punk rocker in Costa Mesa High, who had like a thrift shop dress and bright red hair. And believe me, back in the days of Captain and Tennille, somebody like that stood out. And I just gravitated toward it instantly. I just thought it was some bizarre cult that was making fun of the rest of society, and I wanted in. And then there was this music, and then it just was this wonderful scene. I just loved it. It was, you know, all about dissent and about, you know, mocking society. And I'm a pretty, you know, have a pretty cynical side. So it was a terrific scene. I was really thrilled. It was fun for about four years or so. And then when it kind of got bigger, in L.A. at least, all the people who used to beat us up for being punk became punk. And then they started, you know, beating people up in the punk scene, and the punk scene became a little bit you know, violent itself. And that's when we all started wearing makeup and doing different things to try to even be more offensive. That's when I moved to Italy, actually. At the time, the punk scene was a thrill. And in fact, you know, through Connie, this girl that I met in high school, she got me into punk and also into animal rights. Her mother was a part of some group that sent out literature about protests. And back then, a protest, you wouldn't have any media. There would maybe be three old ladies, somebody in a wheelchair, and maybe a hippie, and then me and Connie, and standing on a street corner. And it was so pathetic. I just thought, this is not a revolution. This is really, really sad. We have to kind of do something here. So we felt responsible to try to make something more happen. And we started then making signs for the protests. We started doing more things like that. You know, the one thing I prefer about that time, and it's hard to imagine now, is that nobody really lives in the moment anymore. They are constantly texting. They're constantly on a BlackBerry. They're constantly on email. They're constantly in touch with everybody. And so there's very little reflection time anymore. And I text and all that stuff, but I have persevered and still very much insist on living in the moment. And I prefer not to have wireless at home because you have to, like, then constantly be looking at things. I really appreciate the time where you can just think about things and think about the bigger picture. And I digress, but.
You've talked a little bit about some things that have attributed to your becoming an activist, certainly the notion of empathy that you had with that flounder, the notion of feeling like an outsider and feeling pushed out of things. What are some other characteristics that you either gained growing up or that, you know, were handed on to you or you picked up along the way that you think have really attributed to you being a very effective activist?
Well, I would really give the credit to my mom. I mean, she's the one who really, really pushed us along to participate in the world. I think most people are, especially kids, their parents shield them from the world's unrest. And they think they're doing them a service, but all they're doing is making them zombies. They're making people never ever take a side in an issue in the news, and keeping these bad news away from their kids. And then all of a sudden, their kids are teenagers and hearing about these things, and they've grown so accustomed to not caring that they never care for their entire life. I mean, if they really care, they might go out and vote for a president. Half the people will, at least. But most of the time, people just, I don't know. It's like they only think about what affects them in their everyday life. And I just always was urged to look at the whole picture. And I was involved in other things. Like back in 1981, the ERA was trying to be ratified. There's, you know, Equal Rights Amendment, which is a big women's rights issue that nobody thinks about anymore. And I was very involved in that and trying to, you know, gather signatures in California for the California to ratify it so that enough states would ratify it and it could march on. It failed. But I had an interesting experience while I was trying to gather signatures. I had a lot of women tell me, how dare you get involved in this? You're trying to gather signatures so that women and men have to use the same bathrooms. And so many people were so stupid, they couldn't figure out that it was about having the same rights in the workplace, the same rights, you know, for parenting rights and all these other different things. And people were so lame about it. And it failed. And I think that it showed me that, you know, it was trying to ice the cake before it was baked. Society hadn't been properly prepared for this issue. And you're seeing it all over again now with gay marriage, where it works in the big cities. But, of course, they're mortified in places like Virginia, where I live, where they now have a constitutional amendment against gay marriage. And I'm against all marriage, gay and straight. I think it's a stupid institution. I'm just trying to give some sort of a parallel. So, I've had experience with that. And I just, the more I looked at all the things that were happening in the world when I was a teenager, the more I realized, you know, I'll only feel like I had a fulfilling life if I devote my life to trying to make a difference with one of these causes. And I want to be involved in all of them that I can, whether it's the gay ones or the women's ones. I've always had a big empathy toward old people and children, the most defenseless people in society I've always gravitated toward. But then I look at what's happening to animals in laboratories and in slaughterhouses, and how they, you know, chickens are tossed into scalding water alive while they're being defeathered, how monkeys will have eye coils inserted into their skulls for hideous experiments, raccoons being skinned alive for their fur, and all of these by the millions just for our whims and for our diets and for our fashions. And I just thought, you know, to me, this is the most barbaric, the most atrocious, and this is the thing. It's happening to the most number of creatures. It's happening in the most hideous ways. This is where I need to really focus my efforts. And so I decided by the time I was a teenager. I'm an animal rights activist. That's what I do. I care about everything else, but this is my focus. And I'm thrilled that there are people that are fighting for the homeless. I'm thrilled that there are people that are fighting, you know, for the environment. But this is my niche, and I think this is what I'm going to stick with. And so that's why I decided to do that. You know, I was almost suicidal when I realized the scope of animal cruelty when I was a juvenile. And I found that the more I did, the better I felt. Even if I just did a little bit one day, well, at least I did something, and I could go to bed knowing that I didn't just ponder it or think about it, but I actually did something. And now, after I've been with PETA 23 years, and you can, you know, read in my book, I did a blitz where I raided Calvin Klein's office and, you know, shook him to his senses and had a meeting with Calvin Klein in which he actually, after 14 years, agreed to stop using fur in his collections. And now I'm friends with him socially. I just saw him. I stormed the Rose Bowl or the Rose Parade float of General Motors dressed as a rabbit to get them to stop their animal tests. They were pummeling rabbits and guinea pigs and dogs in these ridiculous tests to mock car crashes. And they don't do that anymore. We stopped that. I impersonated a janitor to wheel a TV set right past the security and into Gillette's headquarters and up to the executive cafeteria, where I plugged it in and showed hideous footage of animals being blinded and scalded and having their skin abraded in horrible chemical tests for Gillette products. And I ended up in jail, but the company stopped. So doing these outrageous things, and I've been in jail so many times I can't even count anymore, have a result. I mean, we've been able to stop a lot of really horrible things that are happening to animals, and that's what drives me forward. That's my real energy source, is knowing that you can accomplish something. And I suppose the punk rocker in me also gets off on, you know, freaking people out. And then there's a singer named Nina Hagen who moved to
from
L.A.
Germany, right?
She's from East Germany. Yeah, she's a fascinating character, and I write about her a lot in my book. She actually was trained to be an opera singer. Her mother was a huge opera star in East Germany. But they were dissidents, and they criticized the East German government, and they got booted over the wall. And Nina took her operatic training and moved to London. It was like 1976, and got into the punk scene. And so she used her operatic theatrical voice, but in the punk scene, and there was crazy results. Anyway, she moved to L.A. to kind of start her career in the U.S. Back in the early 80s, like 81, I guess. I got to be friends with her, and I asked her if she would write a song for us to kind of put us on the map. That was in 85. And she agreed, and she wrote this song called Don't Kill the Animals, which she did as a duet with another singer from that era called Lena Lovitch. And they kind of sound like cheerleaders on acid who are singing this kind of early rough rap-type song in which they break into a laboratory, and it's very poppy. And it was a thrill for me because I was only 20, 21 years old when I was organizing it, and it became, you know, I got a record deal. I became friends with Morrissey from the Smiths, back when the Smiths were doing their Meet Is Murder tour of the U.S., which was the week that I started at PETA. And I started working with a lot of these punky artists that I had gotten to know through the scene and others that I just wrote. And this Don't Kill the Animals record came out in 87, and it was the New York Times Rock Album of the Week, and it got all this rave reviews, and we did events in nightclubs around the country, and it really gave PETA this great edge. You know, what kind of charities have these events and, you know, gay nightclubs or punk nightclubs? And it was just, it was fun. It was really fun, and it was a great way to kind of spread us out there. And I'd love to play the song, Don't Kill the Animals, so people get a sense of what they were listening to in the clubs back then.
Don't Kill the Animals by Nina Hagen and Lena Lovitch, one of the watershed moments in the life of PETA, the organization for people for the ethical treatment of animals. Our guest is Dan Matthews, the Senior Vice President of People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals. His recent book, Committed, A Rabble Rouser's Memoir, is currently available in paperback, and it's a very interesting read. Dan, tell me about some other watershed moments. You've mentioned getting on the GM float. You've mentioned breaking into Calvin Klein's offices. I think you spray painted something on the walls and got in there.
We used a very tasteful color, though.
I'm glad to hear that. It went with everything else.
Well, there was a big embossed logo on the wall that said Calvin Klein. And so one of our party spray painted Kills Animals underneath it. I mean, we knew that the whole fashion world would watch. We'd never really targeted a designer before, and we thought we should start with a bang and really make them really come to their senses and realize that they had to negotiate with us because they were ignoring us. And it really gave us a foot in the door. I mean, we had to kick the door open, but it gave us a foot in the door of the fashion world, and it led to a lot of other designers who stopped using fur as a result, and they now actually meet with us. I've been able to convince Ralph Lauren, Tommy Hilfiger, to stop using fur, many other designers, and even people like Martha Stewart, who was one of our big targets because she wore fur. I would see her socially sometimes at functions in New York City, and it was always a bit of a chilly reaction whenever we were in the same gaggle of people, you know, because she was a big target of ours. And then she got arrested, and she got sent to jail. And so I sent her a note that said, you know, "Dear Martha, we've had our differences over the years, but now we have something in common. Jail." And I sent her an article I'd written for Details, which was a connoisseur's guide to the world's jails, in which I rated each jail for food, hospitality, accommodation. That was one of the things that led to my book, actually. And I asked Martha to take notes on her cell so that I could update my files. And she actually sent a very nice letter back. I was so shocked to hear from her that she'd had some time to think about things, and she could not wear fur anymore. She would only wear fake fur if she ever wore any at all. And when she got sprung from the joint, she even narrated PETA's video, which you can see at PETATV.com, talking about how she's had a change of heart about wearing fur. And that's my favorite, when people come around. You know, because we live in a very hedonistic world. We grow up in a society where we feel that we are entitled to grab everything we can and not think about it and have the best life and have the most things. And you see these stupid bumper stickers, you know, whoever has the most toys at the end wins. Ugh. I want to ram those cars off the freeway. And just people think that that is the definition of happiness. And they can't help it because we grew up in the world like that. But then when people reflect a little bit that it's really, you know, life can be about a lot more than that. And they change their ways. Those are the people that I really admire the most.
You've been criticized, as has PETA, for the methods that you use, that they're sensationalist and you're, you know, drawing attention and you're destructive and destroying things. And you've also made the statement on a number of occasions, we use sex to sell our message. We use celebrities. We need to grab people's attention in a world that runs a lot like high school.
Yes.
So can you talk a little bit more about
the decision
to use those kinds of methods?
Well, following up on the this Don't Kill the Animals song that we just listened to, that was the first arts project of PETA, the first time we had celebrities involved. And it made a big enough splash in the alternative music scene that I was able to then work with bands like The Smiths and Susie and the Banshees and more popular bands like Howard Jones. And then I started getting letters from people like Natalie Merchant back in the days when she was touring with 10,000 Maniacs. PETA became thought of as this entity you could go to if you were a singer or a celebrity, and they would put you to good use rather than just ask you for a donation. So I organized things like this Rock Against Fur concert with the B-52s and the Go-Go's back in the 80s, and that led to working with more celebrities and Paul McCartney, Chrissy Hynde from the Pretenders. It just really made PETA a cultural powerhouse. And I realized that quite early on when I started working there. The base of PETA's work is serious investigations. We go undercover with hidden cameras into laboratories, slaughterhouses, fur farms, and we bust all these places, and it's on the news. But a lot of people aren't watching the news. They're glued to MTV, or now they're watching things on websites, or they're looking at Perez Hilton, or, you know, we've got all these diversions from the real world now. And I thought, you know, animal rights needs to be there too. And so because the world has become so celebrity obsessed, we have too. And so I made sure that our campaigns always reflected whatever changes were in society, because a movement will be considered irrelevant and invisible if it doesn't sort of change with the times. I mean, it happened to feminism back in the 70s where and it happened to the environmental movement. It happened to the war movement, where people just think of, okay, 60s, let's have a protest, let's have a teach-in. Well, people don't care about those things anymore. They care about nudity. They care about celebrities. They care about scandal and sensation. And so that's what we bring them. You know, we work with a lot of daring artists now, like Pink, people who aren't afraid to say what they feel and to lend their face and voice to our campaigns and our videos. And that's what's made us really relevant. There was a online poll recently, and they asked teenagers what charity they would most like to vote for. And we were astounded to see that PETA was number one, beating out even the Red Cross. And it's because they read about us online. They see our crazy images. And, you know, a lot of things we do that piss people off, people that are in their 40s, 50s, 60s, younger people, teenagers, people in their 20s, most of them think, oh, that makes total sense. You know, animals shouldn't be treated like that. Kids have a great sense of justice. It hasn't been corrupted yet by other things in life. And so I think that's why we gear our campaigns toward a new generation, so that, you know, now we can see that there's a generation that has grown up with animal rights in the news. And that's why, you know, veganism is not that big a deal. And that's why we'll have a much healthier new generation. And it's much more environmentally friendly. And, you know, we don't have to die of all these diseases that were related to meat that our grandparents died of.
You make a statement in your book. It's never the issues themselves, but how the powers that be react to them that tips the scales, causing the masses to take notice and sympathize with the oppressed. And you put that in.
Sounds like such a boring statement.
It sounded really exciting to me, Dan, because you go on to talk about the civil rights movement,
right,
and the women's movement, and you put that in. That whole notion of the fact that the media is the message, really, and you know, you've hinted to that in the sense of using celebrities to grab attention. Mm-hmm. But how else do you see change taking place? One thing is to shock people and make them aware, and the other thing is to create real change.
Well, one of the things you've got to do is you've got to victimize yourself, which is hard to do if you're, you know, a fighter. But what I meant with that statement about how it's the powers that be react to the oppressed, I can give you a few examples. Civil rights in the wake of the Civil War took 100 years to come to the forefront of society again because there wasn't any real leadership, sadly, after, you know, Abraham Lincoln was shot. Nobody really rose to the forefront. And when somebody finally did in the early 60s, and they started having these people refusing to go to the back of the bus and people, you know, demanding integration, well, the powers that be in the South responded by opening fire hoses on people, and that made the national news. And people that didn't really care about civil rights were watching these people have their churches burned and people being murdered and kids being, you know, sent across the street by the water cannon. And all of a sudden they thought, okay, that's got to go. It was because of how the police reacted and how the powers that be reacted. A similar story happened to really launch the gay rights movement. There was a bar in New York City called the Stonewall, and it was frequented by drag queens and a lot of other fun folks. And it was right after Judy Garland died, and these drag queens were really depressed, and they were having, you know, just another night. The police would raid the bar because the police used to raid gay bars and, you know, arrest people, you know, make them show their license. And this one time in June of 69, the police raided the Stonewall Bar, and the drag queens were so upset about Judy Garland's death that they fought back. And this riot ensued, and it was a riot that lasted an entire weekend. And it was something that upset gays all over the country, that the police were, you know, and the fact that these people fought back, these queens, gave everybody this spirit to fight back in their own communities. And so, again, it's another thing about how the powers that be respond. And PETA had a big watershed moment like that. It's not as, you know, much into pop culture as these other examples, but we undercovered videotape in the mid-80s of some experiments that were federally funded, $1 million a year, in which baboons were given hallucinogenic drugs. Then they had their heads cemented into a hydraulic device and had their brains scrambled by these researchers at the University of Pennsylvania. They videotaped themselves doing this, and they held up the baboons by dislocated shoulders, and they made fun of them. And word got out that these videotapes existed. Somebody broke into the laboratory, stole the videotapes, and dropped them off at PETA's doorstep. We got them into the national news, and it was an outrage. It was on 60 Minutes, and the government responded by saying, who gave you those tapes? We're going to prosecute. That's federal property. They didn't even address the animal cruelty. And we ended up occupying the government, the National Institutes of Health. It was my first week on the job at PETA, and I write about this in the book. We occupied the National Institutes of Health for a week to attract attention to this, and it made it onto the Today Show. And finally, these videotapes were all over the national news, and the government's response that we should be arrested for having custody of stolen property outraged people. And even conservative columnists who'd seen these tapes demanded change. And amazingly, the Reagan administration sided with us, and they closed down the laboratory. It was a $1 million grant that was taken away from them. And it was the first time that it had ever happened. And it was, again, the fact that the government was trying to put us down for having, you know, evidence of animal cruelty that was illegally obtained, rather than address the hideous cruelty that was, the central part of the evidence. So that was the big watershed moment for us. And that's what really propelled PETA into the mainstream, I must say.
So when you think about being successful, the successful moments that you've had of getting larger designers to stop using fur or getting a government lab to stop doing experiments, can you think of sort of the common characteristics that come out of that that might even be applied to other areas, like creating social justice for gay and lesbians, creating social justice for African Americans, for people, for other animal rights organizations? What are some of the common characteristics that you can pull out?
Well, I think it's always important to have a list of a bunch of different things that you hope to achieve. And some of these things should be very big things, things that are you can't even imagine winning them, but you should try. But then you should have other things that you're regularly working for on your list that are easily attainable things. I mean, if you're a college group and there's no vegetarian food in the cafeteria, well, demand that and you'll probably get it. Or if they're using, if they're poisoning the pigeons on the campus with Avitrol, which shatters their nervous system and is really atrocious, pressure the administration to switch to netting so that these birds aren't killed and they're kept away in a more humane way. If you're a member of a gay rights group, there's other issues which can affect you, such as having educating the community about violence and gay bashing and things like that, which is really rampant among young people, because a lot of people, when they come to college, it's their first time in touch with gays, and a lot of people who aren't familiar with it react very violently and will beat people up. I know I've been beat up tons of times. And so there's educational programs you can do about that. So I think, aim high and aim low, because you'll win some of them and you'll lose some of them. So I think identifying campaigns and projects is a big, big thing. I'm talking a lot to Chris Angel, the magician who has that show Mind Freak, and he's about to open up a big show in Las Vegas. And he used to use elephants and other exotic animals in his show. And I just, met him last week, and he has gotten rid of the elephants. He's not using exotic animals anymore. He's down to birds. And while we would love it if he didn't use any animals, at least he's moving in the good direction. And so you've got to be happy about whatever victories there are along the way. I mean, people may not realize elephants, to get them to perform these tricks in the circus, they have their heads shackled down to their feet. They are whipped. They are prodded with bull hooks, which dig into the sensitive skin behind their knees and behind their ears and bloody them. They're separated from their families just to do these stupid tricks. And that's one of the reasons why one of our biggest campaigns is targeting Ringling and the circus and any show that uses elephants or exotic animals.
If you had to choose one place to put your efforts, where would it be?
Vegetarianism. The thing is with vegetarianism is it's the core issue for so many problems in the world. The number one polluter on the planet is the meat trade. And that happens in the way that all the rivers like the Mississippi and the Colorado and all over the world, you've got rivers that are diverted for grazing land for animals and for crops that are grown just to give to these animals. And that's one of the reasons we have drought. It's one of the reasons why we have these floods in the Midwest. There's all these problems when you try to manipulate nature, and the meat trade tries to manipulate nature more than any other. You've got the pollution of streams and waterways and bays because of all the animal crap. I mean, these animals crap. You have a dog or a cat that craps, well, imagine millions of pigs and cows and chickens. And that crap doesn't just evaporate. There's chemicals in it that contaminate the groundwater. And especially in a place like the Chesapeake Bay, which is surrounded by chicken farms in Maryland, Delaware, Virginia, That Chesapeake Bay used to look like the Caribbean, and now it looks like a sewer because of all the animal crap that has washed into the bay and choked off the life that's, you know, put so many species of fish out into extinction, and also, you know, it's just a mess. Then there's also the methane from all these animals that is the big contributor to global warming. I mean, it's just a giant mess. So that's the environment. Then if you care about your health, if you don't care about the environment, you might care about your health. All the diseases that we die from, the biggest killers, heart disease, colon cancer, even Alzheimer's now, they're relating it to how much animal products you intake, how much not only red meat, but dairy products. All these things have a pretty devastating effect on our systems. We are not carnivores by nature. We are omnivores. We can eat meat. We can eat vegetables. But with the way that our physiology is, we have very, very, very long intestines. As opposed to, say, felines, they have very short intestines. When they eat meat, and you can see their very, very thin, sharp teeth designed for tearing meat apart, meat speeds through them. They have very short intestines. With us, it sits in us for a long time. It takes a long time for us to digest a dead thing. And it's while that is sitting in us, it secretes a lot of toxins, and that's what causes the cancer. And when you don't eat the meat, you don't have the risk for the cancer like that. Same thing with lining your arteries. It's just, you know, all these diseases that our elders have died of are brought on mostly by our diets. So if you care about the environment, if you care about your health, you know, go to goveg.com and check out some recipes. Even if you just decide you're going to have meatless Mondays and try it one day a week, there's little ways to get started, or you can just jump into it. Then, of course, the animal cruelty. These animals are kept in such hideous conditions on factory farms. Pigs have their teeth ground down so they don't chomp at each other. They have their tails cut off so they don't bite them because they go insane from all this confinement. It's a good thing, the slow foods thing, and organic farms are certainly a step in the right direction, but we live in a gluttonous society. People want things big, they want them fast, and they want them cheap. And for every well-educated, you know, considerate person who will move in the direction of buying something organic, there will be thousands of people who will say, I ain't paying 10 cents more for that. I'm going to go through the McDonald's drive-thru. So when you take a look at the numbers of animals used by animal agriculture, you know, even now, the vast majority, like 95%, are from factory farms. And even with as much organic as you see around, it's a tiny, tiny, tiny thing. I mean, it's a good thing that that some people are being considerate, but it's not addressing the overall problems, neither for the environment nor for the health of the masses. And it's just, you know, I think people won't be that responsible because they just want things cheap and easy. So I do think it's going to be something that comes crashing down.
You've made the statement at another point. I think this is yours. Being obnoxious is our currency. Is that the quote?
Yes.
Talk to me a little bit about that.
Well, we are a nonprofit, and we are taking on all of these huge, huge industries, the dairy trade, the egg trade, pharmaceutical trade, you know, the meat trade, the fur trade, the leather trade, you name it. It's not even Davy and Goliath. PETA is a tiny speck in comparison to all of these huge, huge corporations and international industries. So if we are to have a chance at winning, you know, we've asked nicely, we've sent nice letters, we've sent the documentation, we've asked to meet with boards, and they just turn us away. When we show up at their house, when we show up at their church, when we show up at their office, and we make the issue unavoidable, we buy stock in all these companies that we target, and we show up at their shareholders' meetings, it's through being obnoxious like that, where they don't know where we're going to show up next, that is what gets them to meet with us, because we are a pain in the ass. And most pressure groups are afraid to rub people the wrong way because they want to have support from society. They want people to send in a donation. And PETA is a cutting-edge group. We never intended to be such a large group. We have like 2 million members now. We're astonished that with all the obnoxious things we do, people keep joining still. But I think it's because they see that this is how we get these companies to change.
In Committed, in the book, you talk a lot about, I think it's a theme that comes up over and over again, I don't like to just hang out with like-minded people.
Yes.
And talk to me a little bit about that in your personal life.
Well, you know, there's a big movement. In fact, I've just heard there's some other I heard somebody talking on the radio about it happening in a lot of ways in American society, where it used to be a melting pot. Now it's kind of like people are really going into their own niches and not really, you know, you find it among vegetarians who just like to hang with other vegetarians, gays who just like to have other gay friends, you know, women separatists, black separatists. I mean, it's easy to understand because there can be such conflict by being around people that are have different opinions. But I think that's really dangerous. I don't like that. I think it's boring. I mean, I'm a fag, but I don't only go to gay bars. That would be a total drag. I like to go to places like Hooters, which is like a drag bar but with real girls. It's good to be around people that have totally differing opinions because it keeps you sharp. It makes you realize what the real world is like instead of your little pretend world. And I think that, that it's more exciting like that. I am a vegetarian, but I'm just thrilled to go into a steakhouse and see what they have at their salad bar. I don't believe in separatism at all. I think that you have a more fulfilling life by being around all different kinds of people, and it opens up the world to you in a little bit different way. It may not be always as comfortable sometimes, but hey, sometimes you have the most fun in life when you're uncomfortable.
Who are some of your heroes?
My hero, my biggest hero is Mark Twain. I know people often will say to me, oh, you know, what activist do you look up to? And it's not really an activist that you would think of in the normal sense. It's Mark Twain, who was our country's real first social critic, and he did it through his writing. And I always, you know, kind of aspired to do something in, you know, my own small way like that, because he did it with humor and he was very acerbic. And by the time he was an old man, he just had these really outrageous things to say about everything. He was certainly a big animal rights person. He also came from a slave state in the South and was even a member of the Confederate forces. And he evolved himself. So I think he's a good example of somebody who can change with the times. So he's a big icon of mine. And then my biggest American hero besides him is Elizabeth Van Loo, who I'm probably going to be writing a book about next. I'm not patriotic at all. I don't, you know, I'm not into this whole, you know, I think America was probably a big mistake in some ways. If you take a look at you know, our impact on the native cultures here, if you take a look on our impact on the environment here. I mean, there was a lot going on here for thousands of years before we came along and kind of turned things into what they are now. But hey, you can't change the past. You've got to live with it. So I don't really lose sleep over it. But I acknowledge that this is, you know, it's not really that great. I'm not really that proud. I think we've got as much to be ashamed of in America as we have to be proud. And having said that, the person whose grave I put flowers on every year is a woman named Elizabeth Van Loo, who lived and died in Richmond, Virginia. And she was a well-to-do Southern lady who grew up just before the Civil War and into the Civil War and had slaves. Her father, when he died, told her and her mother in his will that they could not sell the slaves. As soon as he died, she sent the slaves north to Philadelphia, where they got educated, had them come back down. And then Elizabeth Van Loo, who nobody ever thought twice about because she was a woman, operated the spy network in Richmond during the Civil War and was considered by General Grant to be the lifeline of information about when to strike, when to invade. And she was she loved Richmond and she loved the South. She just hated slavery. So she never left. And she was this powerhouse. And that was just, oh, she was fascinating in so many ways. And she spent her own personal fortune. She had nobody to guide her. She just did this herself because she knew it was the thing that she had to do. And after the war, she was appointed the postmaster job of Richmond. And everyone despised her because they knew that by that point that she was, you know, this collaborator. And when the feminists tried to push for women's rights in the South, you know, getting women the right to vote, saying we've got to have the right to vote to counteract the black vote, she then would have nothing to do with the feminists because they were making it a racial issue, which she found disgusting. So she was never a part of any group. She just did her own thing that she knew was right. And when she died, she was considered a total disgrace. And it was a very tiny funeral. They couldn't even afford, and she was a very rich woman at, you know, the outset. They couldn't even afford a tombstone. So one of the soldiers she saved from Boston, his family bought her this plot and this rock. And so I go and put flowers on her grave every 4th of July up in Richmond. It's not too far from where I live. And she was a fascinating character. So she's my real hero because she had everything against her, and yet she just fought and did it and never asked for anything in return.
You made another statement. I think it's in your book. You are doomed to failure if you try to make people like you.
Yes.
Is that one of your reasons for liking her so well?
I think so. I really love the people that go against the grain of everything. I mean, another hero of mine is Nat Turner, who led the first slave revolt back in 1831. And not only did he have all the forces of, you know, the white society against him, he also had the mindset of his fellow slaves who did not want to rise up. And he just knew that it had to start some way. And he got this band of people together. Of course, they killed a few dozen white slave owners in Southern Virginia. He's from right near where I live. And it sent shockwaves to the entire country and sowed the seeds for the John Brown raid, which then spawned the Civil War. John Brown's another of my heroes. You know, there's a lot of interesting, wonderful things in society that should be admired and enjoyed. Then there's some things that are horrible and need to be put out to pasture. And now people look at things like slavery or you know, beating up gays or women driving or women having the right to vote. They take them for granted. They don't realize how hard fought those rights were obtained. And so I mean, that's why I studied history. I studied how all these other movements did it throughout history, and I've always been fascinated by that. And I try to use that in how I guide campaigns for PETA, because, you know, animals, it's even more difficult in some ways. And so I think there's a lot of inspiration there.
What did you love about the process of writing a book as compared to planning a campaign? They're sort of two very different things.
Well, to me, writing is really, really difficult, but it's always something. I've been a writer since back in the punk rock scene. I would write for, you know, punk magazines and all that. So I always had a bit of a twisted take on the world, and I always felt compelled to write it down. And so to me, it has to be entertaining, though. I find most books boring. I think that everything should be funny, and that everything in life can either be boring or fun. And why not make it fun, especially if it's something that's heavy, like animal rights or animal cruelty? So in writing this book, I opted to make it 15 short stories that are in chronological order. So it does read like a proper autobiography, but they are also standalone stories in which you get to meet these interesting characters that I've had the luck to work with, whether it's a drag queen or Pamela Anderson or somebody that I met in jail or somebody that I met at a nightclub at 3 a.m. or somebody that I met on the bus, you know. And there's all these interesting people. People can have a big influence on your life, even if you're just sitting at a bus stop with them for 10 minutes. There are people that can say really provocative things that stay with you forever. And so I really tried to go back in my life, even though I'm only 43, to think of those incidents and to try to get people to think about how in their own life they should really pay attention to the things that cross their paths, because there's a lot of interesting things to learn from to build your life, even if you're not an activist, but just things to inspire you in general. So I tried to have each of those stories be like short stories that have a beginning, a middle, and an end, and some concluding thoughts where you are kind of illuminated about different things. So that's what I really tried to do, and have it be funny along the way. I wanted people to laugh on every page and, you know, maybe cry every 10 pages.
How has being in the spotlight or being around a lot of people who are constantly in the spotlight affected you?
As it's turned out, you know, I now work very closely with people like Pamela Anderson, who's one of my best friends. We travel a lot together, and Pink and Paul McCartney, Chrissy Hynde. And I got to say, the more I'm around celebrities, the more I appreciate my relative anonymity. You know, I can walk into a honky-tonk and nobody really knows who I am unless they just happen to see Larry King. When you're on the news, you're famous for like a few days and then people forget. And that's great. I like being the glue in these projects and, you know, invisible glue, preferably. But when I have to take the public lead, I'm happy to do it. You know, and it's something that's fleeting. Yeah, I'll die doing this. Yeah, it's, you know, I won't ever retire. It's so much fun. I have fun doing all this stuff. And, you know, I still feel like I have the same attitude as I did when I got involved in this, you know, when I was 12 years old or even younger, rescuing cats. It's a lifelong job. But I've been able to work fun into it as well, which I think you'll be able to see in the book. And I also try to lighten up as much as possible and have as much fun. And that's one of the reasons why I picked this next song as our concluding number. You know, there's a lot of upsetting things. We've talked about cruelty and, you know, how people can be so overwhelmingly frustrating and disappointing, and all these political issues. So I try to lighten up whenever possible. And there's this song called Shaking Your Blues Away by Doris Day, who is my second favorite singer from Ohio, the first being Chrissy Hynde from The Pretenders. And this is one of Doris's big numbers. And it's just kind of liberating, and it makes you forget all the nasty things for a few moments.
Dan, thank you so much for being a guest on Profiles. Dan Matthews, the Senior Vice President for People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals and author of Committed, a Rabble Rouser's Memoir. It's been a pleasure, Dan.
Thanks for having me.
an old superstition way down south. Everybody believes that trouble won't stay if you shake it away. When they hold a revival way down south, everybody with care and trouble that day tries to shake it away. Shaking the blues away,
away.
Unhappy news away,
away.
If you were blue, it's easy to shake off your cares and troubles, telling the blues to go,
to go.
They may refuse
to go,
but as a rule, they'll go if you shake them away.
Shake them away.
Do like the voodoos do. Listen to a voodoo melody. They shake their...
The program you have just heard was recorded in July of 2008. The studio engineer and technical producer was Michael Paskash. Copies of this or other programs can be obtained by calling 812-855-1357. More information about Profiles, including archives of past shows, can be found on our website at wfiu.org. Profiles is a production of WFIU and comes from the studios at Indiana University. Christina Kuzmich, executive producer. Please join us again for the next edition of Profiles. For WFIU, thanks for listening.